awesome. Welcome to our sixth and final event in the speaker series related to the 2012 Comprehensive Plan Update. We're going to get started with an introduction by our Mayor, Keith McGlashan.
Well, you just said everything I had written down here to say. Welcome to the final installment of the 2012. Okay. So this is our final one. Did anybody attend the other ones? Oh, good. Good. Some people did. I do want to do some quick introductions in the room. We have Councilmember Hall with us tonight, back in the corner of the room. And the chair of our Planning Commission, Ms. Donna Moss, is here with us also. Our Economic Development Manager, Director is it Manager? Director. Manager will work. Yeah, Dan Earnessy. He has way too many E's and S's and R's and one I or something in his name. But it's a fun name to try to pronounce. For those of you that didn't know, our other presentations were on eco-districts, food forests, transit-oriented development, and other topics that the Planning Commission talks about after these presentations. So, and we invite you to stick around after the presentation, talk with us and each other. We'll take down ideas. I don't know if we have a board. Somebody will have a pencil and a scratch pad or something. But before we get started, we have a video to show you. And I'm not sure what this video is.
Vision 2029.
There you go. We have a Vision 2029 video, and then I'll introduce our speaker.
Working with the community to create a shoreline vision for the next 20 years. More than 300 people participated in the process, generating over 2,500 individual comments. With our community's input, the Council adopted Shoreline's Vision 2029 statement in May of 2009 and incorporated it into the city's comprehensive plan, the blueprint for Shoreline's future. What will Shoreline's future look like?
Shoreline in 2029 is a thriving, friendly city where people of all ages, cultures, and economic backgrounds love to live, work, and play.
Shoreline is a regional and national leader for living sustainably.
The city has several vibrant neighborhood main streets that feature a diverse array of shops, restaurants, and services.
Shoreline continues to be known for its outstanding schools, parks, and youth services.
Shoreline's neighborhoods are attractive, friendly, safe places to live.
The city's real strengths lie in the diversity, talents, and character of its people.
Neighborhood main streets serve as transportation hubs, with public transit providing quick connections to downtown, the University of Washington, light rail, and other regional destinations.
Shoreline is recognized as a business-friendly city, with many small businesses and larger employers providing the services residents need and attracting workers from throughout the region.
The improvements put in place in the early decades of the 21st century have made Aurora an attractive and energetic district with a variety of businesses, shops, eateries, and entertainment.
The city's commitment to community health and welfare is reflected in the rich network of programs and organizations that provide human services throughout the city to address the needs of all its residents.
The people of Shoreline are committed to making the city even better for the next generation.
This is Shoreline's vision. The question now is, how do we make it a reality? Over the coming months, the city will be setting goals and creating policies that are specifically intended to support the realization of this vision of Shoreline by 2029. We need you to be a part of this process. Shoreline can achieve this vision through the dedication and hard work of residents being involved in planning our community's future.
Shoreline.
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 You shared your vision. Now, let's create our future.
Thank you. But I didn't make it, but thank you. All right, now our speaker tonight is Matthew Quantinetz. I'm guessing on that I rehearsed it, but I'm guessing on that pronunciation. So, Matthew, can I use your first name for the other parts of it? Matthew is the managing partner for QBL Real Estate. He advises clients on projects and policies surrounding public, private finance, and the development of ongoing operations in cultural real estate. From 2002 to 2008, he was the developer of then producing artistic director of Capitol Hill Art Center in Seattle. And prior to that, he worked for a variety of arts, entertainment, and festival organizations in producing, managing, and strategy. He was also the founding vice president of the Capitol Hill Chamber of Commerce, Washington, co-founded and sat on the Seattle Cultural Overlay District Advisory Committee, served on King County's Cultural Real Estate Task Force, and on the advisory board of the University of Washington Commercial Real Estate Development Program. Sorry, went to the next page. Matthew received his MBA with honors in real estate at the Wharton School, where he was a Martin Buxbaum Fellow. He is a graduate of Deep Springs College and Harvard University, where he graduated with honors. So without any further ado, please give a Shoreline welcome to Matthew Quantinitz.
Hello, good evening. Really excited to be here. I've been looking forward to giving this presentation for a while. It's on topics that are, as written there, integrated economic development, which is a new and emerging field that basically is taking all social benefits and trying to integrate them into an economic framework. So I think that's very applicable to a city as new as you are here. And with the amount of redevelopment opportunities that are going on here, I think there's a lot in here that you may find interesting. There also may be some that you find a little less interesting, in which case I'll try to move quickly through some of the topics, and then we can circle back in Q&A for anything that you find you want to know more about. So I'll start out just by giving a little introduction to myself, and also the context of this, as I understand it, is to sort of introduce things that might be relevant as you're thinking about the comp plan and sort of actions following the comp plan updates. And then, of course, no economic development talk would be complete without talking about public-private partnerships, which basically are the vehicle that most economic development relationships happen within. There's this thing called the time value of money. There's this other thing called the time value of economic activity. Time value of money is a finance thing that bankers throw around all the time to talk about why they get certain interest rates. The time value of economic activity is about why it's important for the public sector to invest at times when other people are not, and how you can pay for that when you're doing things that are extremely hard at that time. And then a little about land use, integrated economic development, and cultural districts. So I'm going to try, yes, this is better. So who am I? I'm a consultant with QBL Partners. QBL Partners stands for Quadruple Bottom Line Partners. I'll talk about what that is in just one second. I've been working with Dan for the last year and a half, strategizing around different ideas that we could bring to Shoreline or how to deal with particular situations that represent strategic opportunities. Here are some of the clients that I have. I range all over the map, basically standing on the bridge between businesses, government, communities, and nonprofits. One of those groups hires me to deal with the rest of them. And currently, I have clients in all of those sectors that range from Starbucks to the city of Shoreline to the U.S. Department of Energy, doing various and sundry things that seem like, how do those things fit together when you look at them? The way they fit together is this thing called integrated local area development, also integrated economic development, which represents trying to get outcomes that encompass the whole of all those communities. Each of those communities has some idea about what they want more than others. So businesses, for example, are required to pursue profit above all else. That's not bad or good. That's what they are required to do, just like the public sector has a requirement to pursue social good above some of the others. Integrated local area development says we have all of these players acting at once. Can we bring them together to the same table so that rather than fighting each other, we can figure out a way for them to work together? And the quadruple bottom line is about that. It's those four things that are around the blue there: cultural vitality, social equity, sustainability, and economic prosperity. You'll hear it said a lot of different ways depending on what someone's trying to convince you of, but it's basically those four things. So I did a little bit of reading of your comp plan and sort of watching the video and looking through some of the terms that came up as goals that might relate back to what we're talking about here right now. These are some of the values that came up that I picked out. These are all direct quotes. None of this is my language. And we'll keep returning to these as we try to address this issue that I've been given of, the topic of land use. So just as a quick definition, sustainability for the context of this presentation is going to encompass the widest possible definition, because there are so many definitions. So when I say sustainability, it might mean green, it might mean efficiency, it might mean renewables, it might mean eco-districts. I'll try to clarify as we go along what that means. Culture is also something much more broad than arts and entertainment. Culture is that piece in integrated local area development that distinguishes one community from another. It's a strange but very common definition now, because we can't really say this is something cultural and that's something not cultural. It's easier to go from the community and say, how does that community define itself? And however they define themselves, that is the cultural component of sort of integrated development. Talking about the comp plan and talking about land use. So why land use? Here's one of my old firms, Heartland, uses this as a development feasibility framework. Each of the circles represents vertical areas that you need to think about as a private developer, or any kind of developer, really, looking at politics, demographics, all of these different things. Land use is one of these factors that is very important when talking about a comp plan, because it's something that we in the public sector can control. It's something that we can use as a way to sort of refine development decision making without having to spend any money, which is very important, especially in these times. So one thing that land use is trying to deal with is what they call the tragedy of the commons. I'll start out with this dizzying display and then move to a much more comprehensible one. The summary of the tragedy of the commons is that if every individual, say, business, works to achieve its own goals without reference to a larger society, eventually we run out of common resources. It's not because anyone is behaving improperly. It's not because anything is wrong. It's the nature of how business and government are supposed to relate that we protect the commons. In the course of the last 20 years, that's become more and more difficult because of two factors. One, government has been less and less funded. And two, the commons has encompassed more and more things. So those two things have put a squeeze that basically means we're using up some of our resources. So it's an easier way. These are the technical explanations of how when somebody uses some amount of social benefit, it produces some amount of common benefit. But once you use it over a certain amount, it produces waste. And so only a private person accrues to that. That's what this one on the right here is sort of the classic economic view of costs and benefits are supposed to align, whether you're in the public or the private. Once you get more than, this is a fishing example for Lake Ness. Once you get more than four people fishing, which is the vertical line on the left, the black line, when it moves over to the right, it gets out of balance between benefits and costs. I can see I already made it too much in the weeds there, so going to the next slide, this is the easier example. The easier example of the tragedy of the commons, you'll see on the left, everyone in their car saying, why doesn't that idiot use the bus? It works if only one person uses a car. Once everyone wants to use a car, all of a sudden there's not enough street. That's one of these things. Aaron Brockovich, I'm sure most of you saw this movie, an example of a corporation dumping pollution into, I think it was a river that there was no regulation on, and then eventually it caught up. It hurt people at a certain point, and they had to deal with that. So the point of saying this is why we have economic development interventions. This is one piece of it besides just growing the economic pie. There's the defending the social part as well. So given all that, how do we achieve all these things? These are the same comp plan values we just looked at. And it's very important to say none of these are in reference to profit or economic growth, actually. These are all social goals that exist in the public realm. Even attracting business is a social value. And we know today that business is mainly attracted not by economic subsidy, but by quality of life, quality of education, and the places where their employees want to live and they can attract employees to. So how we do this is through these things, economic development and public-private partnerships, which I call P3s from here on out. Economic development, what is it? Yes, the obvious, it increases economic prosperity, yes. But that's what business does already. Why is it different? It's different because it solves these things called market failures, which the tragedy of the commons is one of. There's many of them. It's when the market is not functioning, in the way that we want it to. Believe it or not, despite what you may read in the press, and I am a Wharton graduate, the market is not perfect, nor is it efficient. There are a lot of issues with it that we're supposed to fix when we're working in partnership. And at the same time, it's a requirement in Washington State and many other states that any public sector action must select between alternatives, and in doing that selection, must choose the one that maximizes public benefit. So given two options, must, required by law, must select the one that maximizes benefit, which becomes a pretty big constraint, actually. So what is market failure? Well, as we talked about before, markets value profits, communities value public goods. Market failure occurs when those things don't agree. They don't always disagree. Sometimes you can have great things like Zipcar that I drove over here, where it's sort of solving a social problem and making profit all at once. That's great. I wish everything was like that. In some cases, it doesn't work out that way, and there's a failure of some sort. Causes of failure usually are something like information is lacking, or there's a distribution of ownership, or even worse things like discrimination and prejudice, hopefully much less so here than with some of my other clients in other parts of the country, economic inequity, or also it just costs money to do things and learn things, and sometimes that first barrier to entry is so high that not everyone can access it, and that creates differential between classes of people. So public purpose doctrine, what I was saying before, this is the third component. We're going through what is economic development, you know, maximize economics, solve the market failure, and maximize the public benefit. Those are the three components that we try to do when we are doing economic development. So tragedy of the commons, said in a game theoretic way, is that you sort of have these, who knows the prisoner's dilemma? Oh, phew, okay. So prisoner's dilemma is what you see up here. You got the orange person and the blue person. They're both prisoners, and basically their questioner, their jailer, is trying to get them both to confess. If they confess, they'll get a different outcome based on what the other person does. But they don't know what the other person is going to do. So you see here in the upper left, both of them confess, and they're both sentenced to 5 years from that point on. If neither of them confess, bottom right, they only have 1 year each. So they do much better. So you say, well, why don't they both just not confess then? They'll only be in for 1 year. Well, the problem is, if one confesses and the other doesn't, they do very well. The person who confesses, also called defecting, because usually they're confessing on the other person, that person gets away right away, and the other person sits for 20 years. So the dilemma is, you're one of these people. Do you confess or not? It's very hard to know what to do unless you know what the other person's going to do. So this is a game theoretic framework that people use all the time to describe dilemmas in society. In this particular case, the way we solve this dilemma in economic development is through public-private partnerships, and actually usually through land use. We create predictability by saying to all actors what is going to happen in the future, regardless of how they act. And then all of a sudden, it deals with a lot of this behavior that otherwise would go left or right or whatever direction because of other factors. It's very important to, I spend a lot of time on this point, as you see, the last four slides, because today there's a popular feeling that if government intervenes, that somehow that's anti-business. This argument is sort of saying that it can only be pro-business if government intervenes. That's the only way to create a good business environment of some sort. Now, the level and depth of that, that's for each jurisdiction to decide. So public-private partnerships, I have a couple of examples here just of what they mean, how they work. It's multiple of those parties working together. You'll notice in this example, government, the thing I'll highlight is rights rules. That's very important. And you'll see in every public-private partnership, there'll be some form of that, where the government is the one who's in charge of making it fair, of making sure that everything works well, no matter how many players there are. So here's an example of Parks and Rec from somewhere else. Again, you'll see second from the bottom on your right, I guess, no, left, oversight, rulemaking. That's the government role. The dotted part is the private partner role. And then here, this is triangles sort of showing how there's different projects that can fall in or out of the need for government assistance. There's something else that exists in most constitutions, which is called the but-for clause. Here, it's Washington State, it's a little bit loose, but still, intervention is not supposed to happen unless nothing would happen but for the intervention. Otherwise, it's a waste of public resources. No one really pays that much attention to that one anymore, I'm afraid. So public-private partnerships are created with this idea of land use controls and time value of economic activity. How do you make a public-private partnership? Usually use one of these things. The graphic is showing some of these things in action, trying to change the incentives for how people behave so that with a small amount of intervention, you can get a large amount of impact. When do you make it? Timing is really important. This is the classic diagram of the real estate cycle. So real estate just repeats this cycle over and over and over again. Sometimes it's bigger, sometimes it's smaller, but basically there's always a time when price is out of sync with what is happening or with expectations. So from a public sector perspective, you always are thinking about that and figuring out how you can arbitrage that change. Like if you overpay today, are you going to make it up because the cycle's about to flip later or vice versa? So this is that same thing, giving sort of verbal ideas of what these phases are. The takeaway from this is not to know what all the phases are. It's more to know things just repeat and timing is everything. So you can act in any time, but it's very important to know when you're acting so that you can make the appropriate financial tools and create interventions that pay for themselves, which is always the goal. I mean, in economic development, hopefully they more than pay for themselves. They actually are contributing to the public purse. So land use and its tools, very quickly, in development, you generally have to control one or more of these things in order to do a development project. As I said before, land use takes the standpoint of saying, if we can control the land piece as public sector, we can control how the whole development happens. So that's the piece that we come into here. From a comp plan in general, I had no part in your process, but generally speaking, you try to figure out what all the goals are on the table, map them to the physical resources and the timing of the market, and sort of spread out your goals in sort of low-hanging to long-reach fruit along the way, and use that to map the built environment so you can channel development in the areas that you want it to do. All of that is done in the end. A lot of that is done with land use classifications. There are tools that are zoning. These are a bunch of different kinds of zoning. We could talk about them more in Q&A if you're interested. There's lots of different ways to do zoning. It can be positive zoning, negative zoning, idea-based zoning, design-based zoning, et cetera. Growth management is becoming more and more prevalent. That's a type of zoning that restricts certain kinds of development. Here we're just showing the states where growth management is more or less in use. The darkest green is the highest use. Not surprising, it's on the coasts. And here, just talking about New Jersey, which is one of the most settled states in the country and also my home, so I have a preference for it. It's where I was born. But in most places, you'll find that any particular area that is zoned won't just have one zone. It'll have 6, 7, 8 overlays on it to represent the different kinds of actions that you're trying to achieve. Sometimes that's viewed as problematic. Sometimes it's viewed as positive. Again, it depends on the individual jurisdiction and what the constituency of the zoning actually is. So besides zoning, we also have land itself that can be used as a tool in economic development, whether it's retired facilities that you have here or underutilized lands that also there might be some of that here, or acquired properties that are just in the inventory, perhaps were planned to be used for something else. Again, I'm speaking from the perspective of the public sector now. This is a tool that the public sector can use to create a public-private partnership because they're bringing something to the table in order to create that. And then, of course, there's the things like air above buildings that sometimes has development rights and below grade areas. Usually that's more applicable in a more dense environment, unless you create an overlay that causes more density to be in a certain place. And then there's incentives, everybody's favorite. People like to talk about incentives a lot. Incentives range from finance to direct finance to actual infrastructure investments, a lot of which have been done here over Aurora, and we'll expect when the cycle turns around to see a lot of response to that from the development community. Process expediting actually is one of the easiest and most successful ways to do intervention because it's money to the developer and it's not money to the public sector. So it's an easy place to come together. And then, of course, there's the stick, all the restrictions that one can put on various types of development actions. So Integrated economic development strategy, how do we use all that, lots of words, and turn it into something that is useful? Well, the first thing is that we think about it like a system. Rather than thinking about, and I'm now taking a huge 180, I was just talking about really specific things about land use and, you know, comp plans and all this. Now we're going to zoom back out and talk about the topic of the day. That was all preamble. Here we are. So when we talk about integrated economic development, the integration refers to the fact that you're integrating multiple properties as well as sort of multiple bottom lines. The reason that you have to integrate multiple properties is that a single property does not have much economics for society. It has a lot of economics for the owner, but a single property tends to contribute more to the tragedy of the commons or other similar types of what we call externalities. Single property, it's very hard, for instance, unless the property is huge, it's very hard for it to have any sort of energy efficiency in power generation or water or any of those things. It's very hard for it to set aside common area for the people because it's just one property. So the first step, the really important step, is to start thinking at a district scale. And that's not anything that's different than large-scale developers do. Here's a traditional, quote-unquote, mall lineup. In a traditional mall, some of you probably know this, maybe some of you don't, properties don't exist in isolation, not even economically. The big department stores in the old style retail, right now this is all in flux, but it's still a good example. The big department stores that you think of as, wow, those are the people that are really driving value for whoever owns this place. It's actually the opposite. The biggest drivers, the Lord and Taylors and the JCPenney's and all these people, usually are heavily subsidized to be in this real estate, in this mall development. Why is that? Because their existence causes lots of people to come to this development. And because there are lots of people there, the people that are in the smaller stores are willing to pay more than they would pay otherwise. And those small stores are subsidizing the Lord and Taylors. Kind of amazing that that happens. The reason that it was that way for so long is that it really worked. Today, as I said, it's not the best example. It's still a strategy that's used. The reason that I bring it up is that the concept of the strategy still works. This idea that there's those who are bringing something to the table besides just paying cash in, and there are those that pay cash in order to have that something, and there needs to be some kind of arbiter looking at a systemic level to reconcile those. And so I find it's very useful when we talk about urban development to use this example of malls and anchors and inline stores. So similarly, we'll have to subsidize some things that are good for the overall. Maybe that'll just be a question of the time value of economic activity. We subsidize them today, and then later they more than pay for themselves. Or maybe it'll be a question of putting more of the social goods into the pot. We subsidize them today and pay for it by the fact that it attracts more people to pay for other things that subsidizes. We'll talk more about that in a second. The anchors that we're talking about now, anchor is that word that I'll use for those people that are subsidized, those uses that are subsidized. Here we're talking about public amenities, sustainable interventions, transit stations, cultural anchors, public facilities, all those things that are necessary for the system to work, but maybe don't pay for themselves immediately. So in making a district, there's these three basic pieces that one has to do, regardless of what type of district it is or where it is. So first, we have to create a boundary. The boundary is necessary to allow for any sort of differential behavior inside a region. Then we have to create an attraction or an anchor, some of those subsidized uses that I talked about. And then we have to figure out a way to harvest so that we can pay for that subsidy and all the planning that we did around it. So again, first step is we create a container for place. This idea of creating a district is that it's something that only exists there. Might sound stupid, but you'll go to many cities and find that they've named every neighborhood in the city. None of those are normally districts because there isn't differential behavior or differential economic activity in there. Here, district means specifically we're going to create a boundary. And the reason that's important is that's the only way we can have economic development. We can't just talk about it and give something a name and lay claim to something because we won't be able to pay for it. We won't be able to harvest it, and that's a necessary part of this. So creating the boundary creates an inside and an outside. That's what's needed to create supply and demand economics. just necessary. There has to be scarcity or there can be no differential. And then, of course, we have to measure so that we can adjust along the way. We can't just put in place a district and be like, oh, it did great. I say it that way because there's a lot of those out there, even in Washington State. So first we create the boundary, then we create the anchor. Here's a bunch of examples of different kinds of districts that exist. There's combos, this is not exhaustive, it can be anything. Anything that causes an engine to the place, anything that causes attraction, that can be used as an engine for the district. And then we need to harvest it. This list is ways that we can shift the time value of economic activity. There are ways that we can recapture money that we expend in order to make the district and ways to make them self-financing. Again, all economic development, as much as possible, should be self-financing in the context of the whole of the city or jurisdiction. So, in Shoreline, there's a ton of opportunities. I picked a bunch of ones that are very familiar to you. Again, not an exhaustive list, but ones that are huge drivers of development activity, residential activity, and business activity that also are time sensitive right now. I don't need to read through this list, but they sort of go from reactive to proactive. The ones that create an attraction, like the quality of the education or the light rail stations, and then the ones that create more linkages or abilities to fill in where there haven't been things before. Sorry, I meant to revise that. Okay, so can I give a short explanation, and then we'll return to it when I talk about cultural clusters? The short explanation is that every industry can be mapped. And the mapping goes from what kind of people who know how to work in that industry, what kind of customers does it have, what kind of physical resources, what kind of educational paths. That's called its cluster, the mapping of all those different things that are required for it to do well. Leakage is when, in your jurisdiction, there's some need that could be satisfied in your jurisdiction, but it's not being satisfied there because it's not complete. Usually it's used to talk about retail. So like if you don't have enough high-end furniture stores here, people will drive elsewhere, even though they live here, to go get their high-end furniture. Even if you have one, it's not enough for enough shopping. So cultural cluster leakage is saying there's a lot of elements of great cultural cluster here, but it hasn't been fully put together enough to retain those people to do more of their activity here rather than going elsewhere. So anchor economics, again, just talking about some of these geographical features of where the light rail stations are going to go at a macro level. And then if we take, say, Aurora Square as an example of a more micro level, you have places like Central Market and the proximity of Shoreline Community College. This is just supposed to say it's very fractal. You can look at it from an entire city perspective. You can look at it from a state perspective, and people do. And as you're trying to decide what objective you're achieving, picking your frame of reference is very important so that you can have reference to the things that actually will cause the activity that you want. So the two topics that I am pleased to be able to talk about now are this concept of culture in districts and the concept of sustainability in districts. So these are just extra topics that this leap that I'm making right now is not necessarily logical. These are just the two areas that I am going to talk about as areas that I proposed. The reason why I think they're so interesting is because both of these are extremely self-financing, but thought to not be self-financing. So that's sort of the perspective that I take when talking about them. They're also complete public goods that will draw attraction to place, and they're very simpatico. So, cultural districts, why does someone care about cultural districts? Well, first of all, culture is everywhere. So anywhere you go, if you buy my definition, actually it isn't mine, the one that I used about culture being how a community defines itself, you can imagine that if you start amplifying the thing that makes a community have its identity, that people who live in that community are probably pretty happy about that and interested in staying longer. So culture also turns out to be a megaphone. If you want, you can email me and I'll give you the quantitative statistics on this. I spared you that for this particular presentation. But it turns out that as you integrate economic development strategies, layering a cultural strategy on top of it amplifies outcomes for regeneration, sustainability, education, reduction in crime, safety. It's kind of amazing. There's been a lot of quantitative research on it, and there's reasons why that's the case, which basically have to do with the fact that culture causes people that don't normally interact to interact more. And they've documented that a lot, especially in Philadelphia, Social Impact of the Arts Program. It's the research is stunning. I'm happy to share it with you. And also, culture can be an anchor. It can be a driver, an attractor. So cultural property types can look like anything. These are some of the artistic property types that I'm putting out there because they're a little bit easier to talk about. Don't let this obviate the earlier point that it could be anything. So they could be living spaces, incubators, workspaces, studios. These are, for real estate people in the room, these are all other kinds of property types. So usually when you talk about a cultural property type or something like that versus an office property type, if you said that in a sentence, you're actually comparing two completely different things because culture can look like any of those other ones. So we have housing, and here's some examples regionally and how these things make money and have expenses. We have cooperatives, JVs, and incubators, which generally are the fountain of rebuilding a cluster. We have multi-use centers and performing arts centers. That's usually when cities want to put in a cultural amenity, they want a performing arts center. And that's usually a very large-scale regional impact. In Q&A, we can talk about some of those interesting projects going on in this region. And then we have single-purpose facilities. That can be anything, but usually are dedicated to achieving some specific cultural purpose, whether it's the gathering of a community or a venue for a particular type of art or entertainment. There's a lot of examples of districts that are based around culture or used culture to foment themselves. Everything from Pike Pine in Seattle, Playhouse Square in Cleveland, sort of going around the outside, because I'm not sure you could see this text, Avenue of the Arts in Philadelphia, Granville Island, which is one of my favorite cultural districts in the world, and Third Street Promenade, which is one of those that used culture as a sort of facade to attract retail, but still extremely successful. So how do you select your anchor in this case? Well, the first thing that's important is that you use data, because putting any kind of anchor in place, especially in this day and age, the purpose of the anchor is to drive a certain amount of traffic or cause a certain amount of attraction. So just putting a space that you think could be an anchor somewhere is not a good strategy. It's important to try to measure what type of activity you want to get. This is from some research that QBL has done around the performance of various things that people are calling cultural anchors and how that relates, in this case, to how much real estate appreciation happens to the properties surrounding it. I'm going to say that again because it's not at all obvious or clear. So if you buy my example from earlier with the mall and the anchors, and I said, hey, we subsidize Lord & Taylor, and then everyone else pays more to be next to Lord & Taylor, that's the old anchor model. When I make an argument saying, hey, culture's like an anchor, people don't necessarily believe that if they're in the more traditional real estate world. And the measure that you would use of that is, well, if I put in a cultural anchor, does that mean that real estate around it is worth more? Because if it is, I believe you. And if it isn't, I don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean it's an anchor? So this was a research project that we did a few years ago to respond to some of those concerns about whether or not culture is an anchor. What we did basically was these circles are circles of a certain proximity from the supposed anchor. The first one is within 0.3 miles, which is the generally accepted pedestrian walking distance. So like in a mall or in an urban downtown, usually you're using that quarter mile or so as a measure of what's in a walking path and how anchors affect things around them. So an anchor should affect values of things within a quarter mile. I would say that it qualifies as an anchor in as much as it drives pedestrian traffic. So just the fact that it's a farmer's market, I think it's a good idea. If the intent is to use it to drive people in order to accomplish some outcome, like more people on the streets leads to more safety or leads to more people wanting to do businesses there or something like that, then you can measure and fine-tune it and see what are the reasons people are coming, are they not. But this is the same experiment that we're talking about here to say, okay, does Yerba Buena Gardens count
as an anchor? It's a very controversial one. If you guys don't know, some people think it was a huge cultural success, some people think it was wave of gentrification, et cetera.
So we have these three things, 0.3 miles from the anchor, and then submarket, and then metropolitan area, which is MSA. And so if we're right, there should be a difference between values of property within a quarter mile versus the submarket, and also within a quarter mile versus the metropolitan statistical area. And it's important to distinguish because it may just be that everything in the submarket is worth more. So just comparing the one doesn't give you the whole picture. So this was the original results that I'll summarize in a little bit larger on the right here. This is the same thing. I'm just showing another property. We did the same thing with LA Live, which was another controversial cultural or entertainment district. And what we found was what's in the red circle here. This was only about 1,000 observations over 10 years, which actually is a very small number. But we were just trying to get a rationalization. Is there even reason to think that this might be true? And what we found was those percentages that you see in the circle. And what the percentages are saying is, you take the first one, apartments. Apartments within a quarter mile of an arts anchor are worth 21% more than apartments in the same submarket, not that close to the arts anchor. And you could read it down that way. Development sites, 35%. Hotels, 7. Industrial, 10. And you basically see that it's really retail and apartments that get a big bump, which makes sense because cultural amenities are generally for residents, not for businesses. And so the idea that residents would want to be close to culture makes sense. These are the cities that are represented in that. If anyone is a statistical person in the room, you're thinking in your head, ha, 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 that's so funny. That tells me nothing because we have what we call selection bias. We went and looked for places where arts anchors existed and said of those arts anchors, did they cause a bump? Well, what about all the places where someone tried to put an arts anchor and it failed and it's gone? Or where someone didn't put an arts anchor but they could have and all of those things. The way you deal with that is statistical regression, even more quantitative and perhaps difficult to penetrate than this chart, but here it is. In this case, we took a statistical regression and pulled data ranging from the weather in towns to age of population, distance from parks. Like, we basically went back and said, okay, we'll play statistics. Let's see what this looks like. And pulled out that... this is a little bit weird because in order to talk about a place having more attraction because of cultural, it has to mean that someplace else has less attraction than it. Because a person deciding to move somewhere is deciding between options. They can't go to both. So the way you have to do a regression like this is to talk about rank. That if one place is higher in rank culturally than another place, then does it have a corresponding higher value? Now, as I'm sure you are thinking in your head, this is pretty abstract from should I build whatever, but it's basically just trying to provide the quantitative underpinnings that say property tax will pay for the development of a certain amount of cultural infrastructure. It doesn't matter what it is as long as it has the effect of satisfying the public need. And that was the quantitative high point of this presentation. I hope you enjoyed it. I promise not to go back. Okay, now we'll go for the strategic high point. Cultural ecology, clusters finally, and anchors. So there's a lot of people still in the cultural world that have these ideas about what culture does for your city. And there's profits and then there's false profits. I won't say which is which above. I will say that there's one of each. There's a lot of ideas that get thrown out there that don't necessarily have strategic or quantitative underpinnings. I'm sure you could tell. That's my pet peeve. This creative class idea was something that Richard Florida, the guy with the hands, came up with. It's been very popular. In
2004, it started showing some problems. It's still used by a lot of people today, so I take it as my mission to explain to you that don't use this as is. There's some very good ideas in here that, with refinement, have become better than they were originally put out. And it's the original author that did the refinement. But basically, this idea is the one you've heard before. There's this creative class. Basically, this is like a mythical story. There's this place that is very terrible, and it's run down, and there's crime, and big warehouses, and some artists discover it because the rent is so cheap, and they run over there. And then gays and lesbians go there because they love art. And then cafe people go because they love artists and gay and lesbians. And pretty soon developers come in, and then it's gentrified. That's the creative class redux. And so Richard Florida was proposing that, hey, if you want to redevelop your city, send in some artists. Everything, all that other stuff will follow. Just send them in. And, you know, there's some truth there. I think a lot of times what it was, there was a good coincidence of sort of turning neighborhoods and people that could help that turn. Definitely catalysts are very important. But there's something that wound up happening, which Richard Florida says in the blue below. The creative economy is giving rise to pronounced political and social polarization. Wow, imagine that. You used some people to raise property values, and then they got kicked out of their neighborhood. Amazing that they'd feel upset. This was then refined to talk about how, rather than just focusing on creatives, you could focus on any cluster. If you want to focus on creative cluster, don't just think about the artist at the top of the pyramid. You actually have all of these types of workers that span pretty much every class and income level that you can find, from parking worker attendants to office workers to designers and builders. I mean, it's really, that's not the exhaustive. I'm not going to read the whole list, but it really spans quite a lot. And if we look at creative class in that way, all of a sudden what you're really doing is just reformulating someone else's theory that is the foundation of economic development. And that theory is cluster theory of Michael Porter, who basically, I already explained this a little bit, but it's this idea that there's an economy of scale and scope within regions, and that every region is unique. It used to be way back in the day that cities were built around their idea of some kind of regional competitive advantage. They had access to some mineral, or they had some specialized family that had been making clocks forever, which is the classic example that Michael Porter uses. Or they have access to a river that leads to the ocean, so they're good for trade, or whatever it is. When you start abstracting from that into the modern day, actually, each place still does have the potential for that, primarily now because of differential settlement patterns. Because people of like type tended to come together. And by type, I don't mean race or political beliefs. I mean that when you put a lot of people together who are trying to accomplish something, say, start new businesses, then once you get a certain number of people together who are trying to start new businesses, it turns out that people who want to fund new businesses kind of want to be close to them. And then it turns out that people who want to work for new businesses want to be close to them, and all of a sudden you have Silicon Valley. That's a great example of a cluster. Hollywood is a great example of a cluster. Finance in New York, great example of a cluster. Those are like Uber examples. It doesn't have to be so big to be a cluster. All it means is that by having a cluster, you make it cheaper for people to hire without taking away income from the employee. That's called labor pooling, where somebody can work for like five different places rather than just working for one, and everyone's happy because that employee actually winds up making more. The places are close enough that they don't get added transportation cost, et cetera, et cetera. I'm in the weeds again, so I'm going to zoom out. But this is a really interesting way of thinking about economic development. There's this thing called Porter's Diamond. Porter's the picture, that tiny picture of that guy, Michael Porter. That talks about how to strategically think about regions. When we do this for culture, it helps us understand what things are missing in a particular place. And when Dan and I informally did this, that's when those three words came out earlier. It turns out that we're here in Shoreline, we're kind of missing a certain type of venue and enough agglomeration, meaning lots of different things together, for there to be endemic audience development. So there's a little bit, definitely, you're getting a slice, but you're losing a lot of audience and a lot of artists to other places that are proximate. That's a very solvable problem. And then, just to reiterate, every place is unique. You need to match a strategy to a location. This is an example that I'm talking long enough, I'm gonna skip. So let's move into sustainability. So sustainability in eco-districts, I know we had a presentation on eco-districts, I watched it, wonderful. The sustainability in districts, there's a lot of different kinds of sustainability, there's a lot of different ways that people talk about them. This is not exhaustive, but these are the three types of districts that I personally, just my opinion, have seen working elsewhere. I haven't seen another type of district working based on sustainability. There are a lot where the jury's still out, so it's not to say people have bad ideas. One of them is an efficiency district. Efficiency district is pretty much the most successful self-financing district in sustainability today. It's easy to do, it's known. The barrier right now is sort of information spreading around it. What an efficiency district does is it says, okay, we have this amount of buildings, industry, et cetera, again, within a fixed boundary. Otherwise, we can't talk districts at all. And within that, we're using so much primary and secondary energy, and we're emitting so many emissions. Well, we can change that by creating incentives or public-private partnerships to change the behavior inside the district. That all sounds like it costs a lot of money. The reason efficiency ones work so well is that it also saves a lot of money. So you can use the money saved to pay for making it more efficient or time value of economic activity. So nobody wants to pay for it up front. Public sector knows it will be paid for if we only do it this way and we'll achieve a social goal. Let's do it now and we get paid back with interest as we save money along the way. Power districts are this idea that sharing power or sharing power generation within a certain fixed area creates efficiency, similar as managing water or utility. And then there's eco-districts. Eco-districts, I thought that Rob did an awesome job. I love the presentation. Eco-districts, everyone's got a different definition. They're this thing that's this new thing that everyone wants to be a part of. There's like three or four conferences on them. All the conferences have a different definition of what they are. The way I use it is around, and it's not right, it's just the way I use it, so you know, is around this concept of net zero. Can we create a district that is, in the end, when you measure it, has pretty much a zero impact? So whatever it uses, it offsets. Whatever it manages, it splits and shares, like this kind of thing. It's a very interesting concept, and it's one that if we're going to make a lot of headway on the energy problem, is probably one of the ways it'll have to happen, even if it's not called that. So I'm going to focus on the efficiency in the eco-districts. I kind of already have, so I'll flip through the slides quickly. Why do we even care? U.S. buildings consume 8% of world energy, and buildings consume 40% of U.S. primary energy. 40% existing buildings. All SUVs use 3%. So 40%. The existing building stock replaces itself at about 2% a year in a building boom. I promised I wouldn't be more quantitative, so I'll just bottom line it for you. It would take 40 years to replace all that building stock, and we'd miss every energy target we have, even the much reduced energy targets that current administration is signing up for. Forget about Kyoto, nowhere close. So if we're going to address the problem in a large-scale way, that social problem must deal with existing buildings almost first. There's no other single thing that consumes as much energy that you can deal with on such a systemic level. So it's different in other cities, like New York, it's almost 80%. That's lower now, actually. Hong Kong is probably higher now, so it all balances out. Green labeling is increasing. LEED, Energy Star, blah, blah, blah. I will be the one to tell you there is zero correlation between green labeling and energy use. Zero. There's no correlation. Not saying green labeling isn't good. I'm not saying it's not sustainable. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. You should. But if you want to reduce energy, that is not a one-to-one relationship. You have to, like for example, LEED, you can take a subset of LEED points and create something that's correlated with energy use. But the normal LEED is not. And Energy Star, if you know about that, it's just the top percentile. So if everyone were horrible, whoever was the least horrible would be the Energy Star.
So that's good. I mean, again, those things are necessary. They're important. They have really brought sustainability to the fore. I'm a big supporter of them. But when you think about trying to change things, just labeling it is not enough. This is just to show we did some research in the Wharton Geospatial Lab around whether green labeling was changing consumption patterns. This is a census tract map of energy use intensity. It was correlated with the LEED labeling in order to try to pull out how much of an effect there had or hadn't been over years. The summary is no effect. Efficiency districts can affect this. We know different kinds of interventions that will immediately reduce energy use. And because utilities are 30% of a building's, a normal commercial building's use, that means that we can create something that's self-financing. I talked about that already. Basically, the savings in the utilities will pay for the upgrades. Okay, so that's the efficiency piece. The eco-district piece, there's a million variations. As I said, this is Methuen's diagram. I use this one just to give you a contrast for those of you who are here for Rob's. This is another way to think about it. And basically, they're pointing out what are the different things. All those arrows are different ways that you can move toward an eco-district. Here's their pie chart of the same thing. You can use one or many of these different kinds of interventions that will drive you toward some kind of sustainable district. Again, my pet peeve is management and data and all that stuff. So really what you want to do is decide what is the objective. Is it to reduce by this much or do this other thing? Yes?
The idea of eco-districts primarily just to be more sustainable, reduce use of energy, or is it driven mostly because there's a market for people who want to live in a district like that as an attraction to economic development and
So I think that both factors definitely affect lots of people. It's very hard to say that something that is such a groundswell of interest, like sustainable and eco-districts, it's hard to say what the cause of that is exactly. I will say that both things that you just said are true, that people, developers, and cities have realized that people are attracted to being closer to things like sustainability and culture. For example, the thing I didn't tell you, which I'll say now just to be fair, is that LEED causes currently an uptick in price. So people are willing to pay more for a LEED building. And we know that from a construction perspective, you don't have to spend more to get a LEED building. So what that means is that a developer could make more profit today by making a LEED building than not making a LEED building. So will they make it? Probably, if they know how. That's a short-term effect. That'll be competed away as sustainability becomes required and everyone knows the difference. On the flip side, more people live in cities today than ever have in history. It's now over 50% as of 2004, I think, or something like that. And a lot of what supposedly is driving people to the city is this idea of a more sustainable lifestyle and a lifestyle that has more amenities that are positive effects of people coming together. I would say that eco-districts and cultural districts are both potentially examples of that, not necessarily if they're done poorly, but I think they could be. So not to talk around the question, but it's a very complicated to respond to. So here's an example in our own backyard, the Seattle 2030 district, where they're using management and disclosure to try to guide upgrades to continuously reduce energy use and hit this 2030 target. Disclosure winds up being a really big thing. We're naturally competitive. We are. We all are. Sorry if you didn't know that already. And so when your neighbor's building or your neighbor is using more or less energy than you, it causes a response. It actually causes, we just did a huge amount of surveys on this for Department of Energy, where it turns out it's the number one thing. Like behavioral changes and competing with each other, it's the number one thing. So for those of you like me that made fun of Al Gore when he said, just turn off the lights, that actually turns out to be the best solution to our energy problem. All this other complicated stuff is fine. If we could just get everyone to turn off the lights, we'd be done. And the lights being a metaphor there. Like a lot of things are just very simple behavior changes that have a huge effect. There's a lot of districts that are just focusing on making tools that make visible what's happening so that people's natural competitive response will take care of the rest. Envision Charlotte is another one of those where that's actually pretty much all they're doing, I think. I think they're doing some limited financial upgrades of buildings, but mostly they're trying to get everyone to know how much energy they're using versus their neighbor and how much their building's using versus this other building and all of these other things. This was an interesting example a friend of mine was involved in that I always love to say because it's one of those very clear examples of culture and eco coming together. Basically, Proctor's in Schenectady about 8 years ago was one of these hollowed out neighborhoods and used to be a downtown. And they decided, we're going to do cultural stuff to make it better. Richard Florida, go. And they hired a very savvy guy who said, that's fine. I'm also going to do all this other stuff. And he wound up buying all of these different spaces around the downtown. And then because there was such a huge redevelopment, at the same time, they had ripped up the street. And those red and blue lines, while the street was ripped up, it basically cut in half the cost of putting in a district energy system. So he decided to do it. And he put in place a huge district energy system before there were any users for it. And while the street was open, they closed it up. Within 4 years, it had paid for the entire system. And the funny story that he always tells, which I think helps you remember this example, is that this is cogeneration mainly. It's using heat generated from other things to power, and it makes power very cheap. But what that, because it's right beneath the surface, Schenectady gets a lot of snow, like a lot of snow. Very hard for people to want to go out in that snow to walk down the streets and make it lively and all those things. We live, work, play, all that stuff. So what he did was added an extra radiant heating system that when the street ices up in the winter, he could turn on the system and melt the entire downtown. So there's no ice on the streets, no plows, no anything. And so they saw a huge uptick in attendance for that, which, you know, not a strategy that is sort of out of the rule book. But I think it emphasizes this idea that in each location, you might have unique opportunities. You think about it systematically, you can get a lot. So that's what I was supposed to say now. All regions are not the same. So again, rather than one of those examples being something you should do, the thing to think about, I really think, is these three things. This defining a place, creating an attraction for that place, and figuring out how to harvest the economic value to continue to create this virtuous cycle, whether it's in that place or the next district or the next street or the next whatever, because it's never over. You're always working in that way. So a couple examples for me. This is one I always like to show because people always, we walk through a neighborhood like this and they say, wow, I you're crazy. Why are you working here? Why are you doing this? This is a great example of that. It is Tompkins Square, East Village, about 15 years later from that to that. It's very quick. Like nothing happens for a long time and then all of a sudden it happens. And that's because a lot of what's happening is under the surface. We actually can measure that stuff today. Back then we couldn't, or at least people didn't know how to. Successful district development. I think this is all pretty obvious, but it bears mentioning because while anyone, if you ask them, what would be a best practice in creating something, I bet they'd come up with these steps. Then watch them go create something and you'll see that they skip half of them. They just don't think about it for some reason. Time's so important, we gotta go. It's always important because you can't win without all of these steps. Each one of these is picked because you just can't win without it, because you won't even know if you won or how. So this is a little bit of gold for anyone who wants to make money in real estate or be publicly successful. There's only three ways that this works. There's three ways that you can make money or create positive self-financing interventions in a built environment. You have to either identify a where, a when, or a value add. The where has to do with understanding that in a certain place, the elasticity of the property values is higher than norm. What's the elasticity? The elasticity means that the price is one thing. And if you look at, say, all the houses in the country, how much do they increase in price? They increase by about, let's say, 2.5% per year, which is the long-term average. 2.5% per year, houses increase in value. Oh, wait. In Shoreline, these houses here, because of something that's been going on, have only been increasing at 1%. And when that something's fixed, they're going to bounce back faster. They're not just going to go to the average. They're going to have to increase at 8% to make up for all that lost time. That's high elasticity. That's not the only way you get it, but the concept is that rather than a normal price movement, it's more susceptible to being affected by outside factors. If you can find that place, you can have a successfully self-financing intervention. Whether that growth is going to be less or more than normal, if you can understand how that works, you can do it. There's a lot of examples of that, and that's the way most real estate developers make money. The when, this is usually the province of nonprofits and public sector, but the when is that everyone wants to be part of a crowd. Everyone thinks everything's in the tank until they all think it's great. If you have a strong enough mind that you could say, you know what, I'm going to invest now when everyone thinks it's bad, because I know it's at least going to go back to the mean, if not better, then you can make money or make a self-financing intervention. That's the one that's most challenging to convince people of, because it only works when everyone else tells you you're wrong. Once everyone agrees with you, it no longer will work. You're too late. So you have to actually do it when everyone tells you it's the wrong idea. Now, there's a long history in public sector redevelopment authorities that purely do this. And if you go to certain old industrial cities like Philly or, Detroit can't anymore. But if you go to some of these places, you'll find that when the cycle dips, they have all of this money that they've saved for that moment, and they go out and buy everything they can. They don't even have an idea of what they're going to do with it. They just buy it because they know that eventually, at worst, they'll just sell it off later. But at best, it'll be that one property that's the only time they could get. At other times, everyone wants it. So countercyclical, against that cycle. You're buying at the time when it says not to buy. Again, time value of economic activity. And finally, anchor effects. That you know by putting in X, Y, or Z, or you know X, Y, or Z is going to come in, let's say a transit station, before everyone knows there's going to be a transit station. Let's say you know before everyone else at 145th and I-5 there's going to be a transit station. No one else knows. You go over there and you're like, I'm buying all the land around here. And then once it's announced there's a transit station, boom, all of a sudden that land is worth more. Same thing as we were talking about with the arts anchors or a retail anchor. That's all that value add piece. Value add's usually used in a different way, but this is another way to do it. Okay, so here's two quick examples, or three, because I talk about you guys briefly. Here's an example of the where. I'm working right now in Augusta, Georgia, which is an incorporated county and city in one, and we're working off of property value elasticity. We're looking around at this region and saying, wow, these prices are not what they should be. We didn't go there for that reason, that my client is the government. They said, what are we going to do here? How do we fix this? We need more street activity. We need to resolve racial relations. We need more artistic activity. We want to raise property values. Like, what do we do? So we spent 3 or 4 months looking into it, and we said, okay, for economic development, the opportunity here, the one that we can use is the where. Because right now, you have all the fundamentals that should make for actually a very robust built environment, but for some reason, it's being held back. It's being held back by the following factors that we think we can address. So we make a map. We are creating certain kinds of investments in anchors that will lead to a perception that everything is fixed, and then that will become self-actualizing because people will start acting. This is the first step of the intervention is we're doing a $50 million bond issuance that just passed, yay. To redo all of the cultural facilities. But part of what we're doing is designing the cluster. And people are not happy about this, by the way, because previously philanthropists just picked their pet project. This is my theater. I want it to be this. And so many people did that there's too much supply of art spaces, and so they're all failing. And so one of the things we're doing now is saying, okay, we're going to fund every arts organization that works with us to rationalize the ecology. We'll rebuild your space, we'll give you a new space, but you have to share it with X, or it has to be this size. So this is the first step. We're mapping out where all of them are. We're bringing in ArtSpace, who I'm sure some of you have heard of, to do a first sort of live-work development. They're a nonprofit developer. And then after that, our next step is going to be to create an eco-district around the downtown, an efficiency-based eco-district. So I think that the thing that we should think about here is more about the when. Right now, So from my opinion as just one guy, when the market turns around, if the right noises are made, Shoreline is one of the most desirable places for a real estate company to invest in today. And by company, I don't mean local developers. I mean, there's a whole host of national and international money that has billions of dollars that they're waiting for it to be time to invest. In other words, they're still saying no, no, no. That means that right now is a good time for public sector here to say yes, yes, yes. What are the most desirable areas that someone's going to come into after this flips? And how can we put in place the kind of controls that when they come in here, yes, they get what they want, but it also funds some of the other infrastructure or services or creates public space or whatever the goals are from the comp plan that we want to focus on. The what in Philadelphia, we're doing a 10-county, so Philadelphia is one of 10 counties in which we're trying to do a full efficiency upgrade of the entire commercial office sector, in order to mainly create jobs, but also create attraction for people to reinvest in the area. So three examples. That's it. I made it to the end. Woo! So I'd like to turn, if there are any questions, I'm going to do a mic switcheroo.
First question, are we cold? Do we need to shut the door? Okay. Okay. And then... we are recording this, so please ask your questions into the mic so that the people that are watching from home will have the benefit of hearing your questions. So who wants to start?
When every time you mention the word shoreline, you threw up a slide with the two light rail station perspectives. But there's a lot more to us than that, and that's way out in the future.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of other economic fish to fry around here and cultural fish to fry, and it would be helpful to talk about something a little more immediate than something way in the future. And for instance, Aurora Square or North City or Central Shoreline and some of the things that can be done to enhance our cultural and economic viability?
That's a great question. Thanks for bringing that up. And Dan is coming in on cue. Actually, the reason that I chose those ones was because they're so far out in the future that they wouldn't cause any controversy. There's a lot of activities going on now with the CRA being established in Aurora Square. What is that?
Community revitalization area.
So basically, in Washington State, there's a and in most states, especially west of the Mississippi, because of factors I don't need to mention, there's a prohibition against the public sector working with the private sector, except in very specific instances like fire stations, schools, et cetera. So when we want to do economic activity and make partnerships like the ones I'm describing, the first step in Washington State is that we have to create something called a CRA. And so for the last while, Dan has been working hard with council and staff to get that passed in order to start working on Aurora Square in the way that you're talking about, try to figure out what kind of partnerships and redevelopment and all of those kind of things can happen. So I think that's the most immediate example that I have anything to do with, which is trying to strategize around what can happen there. In terms of the light rail, I will say also that it's not as far away as you think. it's quite close in terms of planning. I think that the given capacity, the time for planning is now with things like that, because the cycle is so long until it's over. Like all of a sudden there's a speed up, there's a change in plans. I know we dealt with this on Capitol Hill that we were talking about earlier when we founded the chamber. One of the main things was to try to negotiate with Sound Transit, and they refused to negotiate with us all the way until the moment that they said, you missed your opportunity. And so it became this kind of thing where we did all the planning anyway, and then we actually had to picket them in order to get them to sort of partner. So it's just something to think about in terms of lead time. In terms of specific recommendations around these ideas for Shoreline, I mean, I'd be happy to respond to any specific question that you had, but I definitely, one of my particulars is that it's not for someone like me to say what should happen in a community. It's more for me to help elicit what the community wants to happen or what linkages can be made, like clusters fixed, for example, and then help actualize and finance the solutions that the community wants to see happen. And that's kind of what I was getting at with the, there's no replicable solution, there's just a process. So I could tell you about the process all day long, but I'm totally out of place to tell you what you should do with X, Y, or Z. I'm trying not to avoid the question, but feel free to follow up if you feel that I have.
Well, given your theory and your presentation, and based on the reason Shoreline was incorporated, which was to protect the school district, that you would think then what would flow out of that would be a community committed to education, and that we would have not just our public school district and our community college, but that we would be building a cluster around education, literacy, knowledge, so on and so forth, if your theories were to play out.
Mm-hmm.
So we would be a city with a bookstore
mm-hmm.
on every corner, and we don't have one, and so on and so forth. So if we were to take what caused Shoreline to become an incorporated city, given what you discussed tonight, then we would play on that concept, and we would further enhance it in order to bring people here. When you described how, in terms of location theory, for instance, we have a performing arts center in Edmonds. We have one here. We have one there. We're minutes away from downtown Seattle. So what we're not going to get is probably pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
What we could get that would differentiate us is what we're looking for, and,
mm-hmm.
and what we've been looking for 17 years, you know, is how to differentiate ourselves in a way that causes us to stand out from other places economically.
Yeah.
You know.
I think there are a lot of opportunities. You have hit on one of the ones that's my favorite, which is education. There's so many opportunities, I wouldn't know where to start. The issue that you always have in these kind of things is how to bring enough of a community together that electeds have a mandate to pursue some specific course of action. Because the mechanics around doing what you're talking about are not difficult at all. The mechanical problem is, how do you know that that's what's desired of the community in such a way that it's a positive for electeds to take a stand on it? And I think that that's our job as citizens, to sort of rally those groups together so that they know that that's the case. In terms of specifics, I mean, the thing that cluster theory tells us about education here and how to get more schools is that you should train more teachers here. That doesn't seem obvious, but it's better than building more schools. By training more teachers here and getting more teachers to live here and creating things that this becomes a teacher's place, schools will happen, I promise you. That's a sort of missing piece. You have people that have moved here because of the education. You have a city that's formed around the idea of high education. You have high-performing educational institutions. You have a good credit rating and all of that stuff. So the thing that it needs to sort of push it over the end is to redefine the place as a place of teachers, because every place is a place of education. The distinguishment would be that this is the fount of education in some way.
Other questions?
I was very interested in your idea of cultural clusters and the momentum behind them, and how do you get them started and keep that energy flowing towards it and make it something marketable, et cetera, all that momentum that builds around it. And I think about Shoreline and wonder, and you talked a lot about districts being sort of the model for that. Can districts be too big? Can there be too many of them that would take away from the momentum of getting a few things started? It sounds like you understand my question. Do you have any ideas about that?
Yeah, and stop me if I'm going astray, but districts can definitely be too big, and that's usually the biggest problem that normally happens. However, they have to be of sufficient size that they can cross-subsidize the public benefit. In other words, usually a district will pay for the subsidy of its benefit by quote-unquote taxing the other members of the district. It's not really a tax, but you know, some people pay extra to be close to something, or there's a bid, a business improvement district. So it has to be of sufficient size that it can pay for whatever sized amenity you're trying to do. With cultural districts, if you're talking about things that drive traffic, meaning places that have lots of people coming to them, which not all cultural amenities do. But in that case, the size is usually 10 to 15% of the total building square area can be something heavily subsidized at 50 to 80% subsidy without causing any undue burden on anyone around. It basically reaches equilibrium. That's very specific to a specific kind of district. I think the takeaway from that response is it's all about measurement. And you can know in advance how big it should be. Usually, best practice in economic development is to start as small as you can, as long as it's of sufficient size, so that you can maximize the supply-demand dynamic. You can maximize how much scarcity there is. But in places like Detroit, that's not an option, obviously. Or even Augusta, that's not an option. Place like here, I would say that should be your strategy. Pick out areas that you can demarcate that are as small as possible, that still are large enough to accomplish whatever the public benefit goal is there, whether it's to get a certain kind of cultural amenity or to get the beginnings of some kind of cluster that we don't see elsewhere in the region that could be useful here. And I know there's lots of ideas of that have been thrown around. Or it's to pay for some public facility or public park, or we can size it all based on the public benefit. And that's why what I was saying before, where'd that go? Yeah, identifying that objective and measuring the baseline and projecting to desired outcome, those three steps are what we just said. Like, okay, what are we trying to get to happen? Why are we even thinking about doing a district? Okay, given that we want to build X amount or create this thing or create this much new tax base, where are we at now? And that's measuring the baseline. And then, you know, what size intervention or tax or subsidy would be needed in order to get to where we want to go? Oh, wait, that's too big. Let's expand the area. Or that's too small. Let's shrink the area. That's sort of how you size what it should be.
But if growth is do you factor in the rate of growth of that district? If it's looks like it'll grow slow, do you think, well, we don't want it too big too fast because it'll just seem like it's not moving at all?
Yeah.
Vice versa.
Always project it to grow slower than you think it will grow. It's just a little that's a little free tip. It's like we used to say in the theater, and it's like Dan said when we were first coming in today. Make fewer seats. If you fill them up, we'll bring out more. Everyone will be happy. But if you have too many and it's half full, everyone will feel like, oh, nobody's here. So I think the same theory with districts. And, of course, you think in your head about and you set up where are we going to expand to next. Do we have that right of way? Do we have the ability to do that? But you don't want to announce that any more than you want to announce any sort of anchor that's going in until you've established, you know, your value capture mechanism so that you can pay for it.
Matthew,
yes.
I have a question. You know, when I'm at a soccer game and then I'm talking to other parents and they learn I work for the city, naturally their question is, why can't we see a Red Robin here or, you know, some other types, not to disparage, you know,
yeah,
the great restaurants we do have here, but, you know, they're kind of really, why aren't we seeing more of these things in our city? I have to leave my community. I have to go to, you know, Seattle or Linwood or Edmonds, and I want to be here. I never know really how to respond to that question in a way that I think satisfies them.
Yeah.
So if you have any comments about that.
Well, there's two questions there. One is the actual answer to the question, and the other is how you should respond when you're at the soccer game. How you should respond, that's the easy part of the question. Oh, it's coming. It's coming. How to get it there is, the long way around the barn to answer that question is every retailer has a demographic, psychographic, and economic test that they use to decide where their next locations are. And you can apply that test too and see why they are, where are you lacking. And that's something that normally happens right after you do a retail leakage study. You'll say, okay, we're losing on furniture, we're losing on mid-market restaurant, we're losing on this, why? And then you can figure out what are the gaps in the ecology of those things that you need to fill in order to deal with them. Now, in this particular case, I think that there's also a potential kinetic energy moment. I think after you get over a certain barrier, you'll see a large influx of those. And the bigger question I would have for you when you think about that is be countercyclical. It is going to happen. So how do you want those to lay out? And what can you do today to set that up so that when it does come in, they're not next complaining to you about, well, how come the only restaurants we have are, you know, you want to leave room for all different types because different types appeal to different people. I think there's a response here behind you, Dan. Oh, you're going to respond too.
I was just going to add, based on your anchor theory, we don't have enough inline shop space next to desirable anchors. If we had a lot of room around Aurora Village where Costco and Home Depot was, we could probably attract quite a few more restaurants and so forth, but it's all filled up. And they're but if we can create other anchors, and the change has been that Aurora developed out as a retail strip in an era where you didn't need an anchor. The highway was the anchor. But now that has changed, and a Red Robin, for instance, will not locate unless it's next to strong retail draw anchors. And so you see them at malls, and you see them at these places where there are anchors. In fact, they shut down the original Red Robin, which was unanchored. And I think part of the big reason was because they were so committed to that. You know, it has changed so much since the 70s when that Red Robin was originally built. And so that's one of, I mean, that's a very long answer for a soccer game, but it might be a slow game.
Yeah.
So.
Well, one of the things that confounds me is that given that Aurora Avenue is a commercial strip, and even though we've made it beautiful, it's still a commercial strip, which I'm happy with. I consider the regional attractions up here as anchors. Dunn Lumber is a regional attraction. Aurora Rents is a regional attraction. Frank Door Store is a regional attraction. Sky Nursery is a regional attraction. We have a number of them. And this may seem simplistic to you, but say North City, where we have Frank Door Store, people come from, according to some people, you know, from counties away to buy doors there. And why aren't we selling doorknobs next door? And why aren't we selling cute little doormats next door? And how do you get people to imagine the in line, what you sell between the anchors, between Sky Nursery, Dunn Lumber, and Aurora Rents? There must be 1,001 things that people would also buy if they just wanted to make a Saturday afternoon of it. And that just confounds me that we haven't figured out how, once somebody comes up here from wherever they came from, how we keep them here for the afternoon, and they go home having spent not the $100 they came to spend, but the $400 of impulse shopping that we do when we go somewhere else.
Yeah, it doesn't sound simplistic at all. It's one of the things that people spend a lot of time trying to figure out. And the turning that $100 into $400, that's the golden goose or the grail or whatever you want to call it. That's what Dan spends a lot of his time thinking about, how we do that. The difficulty with the example that you gave about the doorknobs is that it's not really the public sector's place to say a doorknob store goes here and a this goes here and a that goes there. Not to say that some people don't do that, but and who am I to say they shouldn't? But in general, that's viewed as something that goes a little bit beyond, which is why the Obama administration got so much garbage about the Solyndra and all those things, picking winners. But who is the other person? Well, that's something that there definitely will be strategies around in terms of trying to figure out how to attract those people. But it gets complicated because there's a lot of different players to unite in that particular example. There has to be a vacancy, a business, a good rent, favorable timing, the right location, you know, all those things. It's hard for them to sync up. But I think that's what you're describing is exactly the goal.
Just mentioned the factor that I think is missing from most of the thinking, and that is the rent. If you can go 3 miles away and pay $10 a square foot, and you can come to good old Shoreline and pay $30 a square foot, tell me what business wants to operate in Shoreline. If you ask anybody what they want more than a Red Robin, they want a job within walking distance or a bicycle or a short trip. And we have created the impossibility of businesses coming here because we've ramped the square foot price for development, for new business, or for that matter, for housing, out of the affordable range. Hmm. You have to do something to bring those numbers down. Otherwise, I and any business that wants to come anywhere is going to go to Linwood or anywhere else. Simple.
Yeah, it's a good point and one that I know is on the minds of everyone. There are solutions to that kind of problem, but the solutions usually revolve around making certain areas the capability of the same square footage of land to go higher, so it raises the per floor or lowers the per floor cost to people. The other thing that has worked, despite everyone saying that it won't in every city, is as you ramp up the benefit of locating in a certain area, it eventually winds up making that cost worthwhile. Now, I'm not a business owner here. I don't know what the balance is here. But for example, in a mall, you know, the rent is four times often what it is in the downtown, but people still locate in the mall. Why? Because they have the benefit of higher square foot sales or better management or cleanliness or whatever it is, combination of those things probably. And so if services are out of pace with real estate, then that's a really serious problem that has to be looked at. Again, I'm out of my element in saying that. I don't know what the situation is here. And it could be different from area to area. By working on a district basis, you can address it in each area as well. And hopefully that's what will happen.
Other questions?
I have a question for Matt or anyone else in the room in terms of, as we're looking at the ecosystem and districts and development and size, are we exploring other cities around the region, the size of Shoreline, in terms of what they're doing, what's working there, and what could potentially happen by, you know, 2029?
I'd be happy to answer that. Absolutely. We're trying to keep our eye on many comparable cities, and comparable is defined in different ways. Sometimes it's size, sometimes it's location. I believe there's a strong correlation with what happens by how far away from the Space Needle you are, which seems kind of like a funny indicator, but there's a band of cities that are roughly 15 to 20 miles away from downtown Seattle, and we all experience similar issues. And so those are those are ones that, that we have to keep an eye on. But across this state, we have, across the Puget Sound area, we have certain cities that we keep very close track of how they're doing with assessed property value, how they're doing with retail sales tax and so forth, and try to steal good ideas as much as we can from them and avoid mistakes as much as we can from them as well. What happens oftentimes is the young areas, for instance, an area that I worked in the private sector, Covington, is a rapidly growing suburban area, and it models very closely to where Shoreline was maybe when it was rapidly growing and ramping up. And just like that real estate graph that Matt showed a couple times, I believe there's similar kind of systemic cycles that cities experience. And frankly, we're on a very, we need to redevelop. We don't have raw land. We don't have green fields to develop. So we're looking especially at those cities that are going through that redevelopment era. I think that's why it's so insightful that the city council decided to embrace and improve Aurora. We really stepped up to the plate there because this is the kind of thing that you do for the next 50 to 100 years.
Other questions?
I have one more.
Mm-hmm. So I work in downtown Bellevue, and you know that place has exploded tremendously the last several years with the businesses that they can attract to come into the community and what that does to the mall and various areas. Would you foresee a certain type of business that could come in and be a major employer in Shoreline, and you know how that would jumpstart the ecosystem?
You want to answer that?
I can if you want. Yeah. I mean, you're the.
I'll start, and I'll let Matt. I think. Matt and I have been working together a lot, so a lot of the thinking that I have, I think, is really thanks to him. But if you look at it at a systemic, kind of big organic system type level, then you start looking what's just over the border and what Shoreline, Bellevue, what's just over the border from it is Microsoft. And obviously that had incredible wealth creation and so forth, and that has driven a lot of different things. When you look at Shoreline, we have a very strategic location. That's why we developed out really as the first bedroom community for Seattle. And so we're also very strategic. And so, but just at the right edges, just at the edges of it, we have that whole thing going on in South Lake Union. We have the whole Gates Foundation, World Health type thing. We have the University of Washington that we're really positioned, we have a better position than any other city besides Seattle itself. Not only because of our proximity to it, we don't have to cross a bridge like Bellevue does, but we also have two light rail stations that are going to, connect to two light rail stations, right, that surround the University of Washington. So that's kind of been my thinking. Obviously, you got Boeing too, but a lot of Boeing is driven by cheap land and big factories, and so we're probably, if we go that way, it's probably going to have to be on the high-end small things or the intellectual capital. So those are kind of not real specific, but Matt, I don't know.
I mean, I'll be a little bit, I'll add to what you said from our common thinking. I think education is another place that we're really looking at, both from the UW and also expansion of the community college, and what opportunities that might offer and how we could promote that. And there's been a lot of talk around health and medical and just what kind of opportunities there might be here because of the location and because of the kind of land that's available that could be something that builds out very interestingly, especially because of the rent differential. When you look at the rent of here versus maybe someplace like Linwood, that's one thing. But look at here versus South Lake Union, and that's a very different thing. And so it now becomes a cheaper alternative that if you build the right kind of cluster, it can attract a lot of high-end jobs and also bring services into the region. And then, of course, I'm always looking for cultural and entertainment kinds of things as well as sustainable. And I think there's some good opportunities for maybe 5-10 year job boost from sustainable that could lead to the creation of clusters here in sort of construction industry around sustainability, or could just be a temporary boost. And then for entertainment, there's a couple of areas that are really lacking regionally that Shoreline might be well positioned to be a part of. Film and video, there's some really sore lacks right now in terms of soundstage infrastructure that nobody has been able to solve. SeaTac, Seattle, Bellevue at one point, I've worked for all of them almost to deliver that, but it hasn't happened yet. And because of the flight paths and transit and the kinds of people who are here and the community college, it's actually a really good place to try to build out a larger soundstage infrastructure, soundstage being the thing you use to make movies, film, all of that. There's been a lot of effort at the state level and also at Seattle level to try to encourage more film to happen by giving them bigger and bigger handouts. But actually the problem is something totally different, which is that there isn't infrastructure. So no matter how many handouts you give, there still isn't a place where they could do the major things. And there have been, as I said, several attempts that have stopped. And so we've started talking about, is this a feasible thing that could happen here? How many jobs would it create? How would it spill over? Is it worth looking into? That kind of stuff.
And
what's that?
I would add to that, you know, that part of our thinking has become because Shoreline Community College has a great film, digital film production program. So, I mean, it is, again, you're looking at your assets, you're looking at how close you are to downtown Seattle, the flight path. I mean, who would have thought of that? But, you know, the fact that it's quieter here
deal.
Is a big, big deal for this particular industry. Just like Moses Lake has an advantage of having really cheap power and lots of cheap land. So there, you know, if you want to build a data farm, Moses Lake is your place. If you want to build a soundstage, you know, it's too far away from the artistic center hub of Puget Sound region.
Anybody else? So we have a few minutes left. We have this handy dandy little whiteboard here. If anybody once has any thoughts that they would like to capture for the comprehensive plan, I'll give a quick plug for that in case people start leaving. the Planning Commission will be discussing the first full draft of the comprehensive plan next Thursday on September, I believe next Thursday is the 18th, and then the 20th, and then the public hearing right now we're looking to have on September October 18th or 20th, which I've been playing with those dates too much lately. I don't remember which one's October and which is September. But if you go to the Planning Commission website, the first draft will be loaded up there by the end of the week, and you can see what we have. You can look at the economic development chapter and the land use chapter and see what we have in there. If you have pieces that you would like us to fold in from the topics that we've been discussing this evening, that's great. This concludes the final comprehensive plan speaker series. We are trying to get together a sustainability forum at some point, probably in October or November. So keep check your email. If you were on the mailing list and that's how you found out about this, then we will use the same mailing list for that. Otherwise, thank you very much for coming. And does anybody have any final thoughts they would like us to capture? Thank you, Matt. Thank you for coming.